Hello, everyone, and welcome to minute 77 of season 3 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action movie Die Hard, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me again today is Brian Lockhart of Hamilton Shot by Shot, among other things. Welcome back to the show, Brian.
Well, thanks for having me back, jerkweed.
Hey, Geronimo, you.
Hi, sorry, I didn't mean to start off so angry.
Nah, that's okay. I meant to say
I'll take it under advisement.
Yeah, you take it. You do that. You do that. You do that, you jerkweed. There you go. That makes more sense. So, minute 77 begins with John putting a pin in it and ends with smoke continuing to rise outside. So, yesterday. Yes, it does. So, yesterday, we ended things with Hans giving James and Alexander the go-ahead to shoot. They shot again their missile at the very strange angle and hit the RV once again. And now we're trying to focus on John while he's trying to figure out what to do to stop it. So he had put C4 plastic explosives on a chair. And at this point, he starts taking all the detonator pins and tries to figure out what to do with them. He puts in two of them, and you can see he really has absolutely no clue as to what he's doing there. And he goes, "Ah, fuck it," and then puts a third one in, you know, just for the sake of it. And you know, we're trying to figure out what it is that he's trying to do here with this whole thing. Also, you know, thankfully yesterday I read about, you know, how you could actually have C4 do something, because, you know, I wouldn't have known to put the pin in it. I would have just taken the C4 and just thrown it, you know, expecting it to, you know, do something besides feel like silly putty, as you said, or serious putty, as you called it. Who knows? And then we get a shot of Alexander, who is screaming in German at James. And James then waddles off towards the crates, and he moves the top crate off, and he seems quite disappointed as he continues to look on that there isn't any there. You know, that he's missing something. And then we go back to McLean, and he takes a computer screen and puts it on top of the C4, and he takes the cord and starts wrapping it around it. What do you think he's trying to do here?
I don't know. I was going to ask you that. Like, what is he really trying to accomplish? But I didn't know if he I really don't know. I assume he's trying to hold the C4 in place or make sure the detonators don't fall out. Or maybe when it hits, the computer will push down on the detonators. I really don't know. I'm hoping you can tell me, because
the only thing I could try and think of is that he wants to have more heft in the whole thing, to make sure that you know, he knows that it's going down 30 something flights. So maybe he's saying that he needs something, as you said, to keep it in place.
Yeah.
So that sort of makes sense that's what it could be.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't try and research how does it help to put a monitor on top of a C4.
Yeah.
Doesn't really work that way. And at this point, he's basically talking to us, and he goes, "Let's see you take this under advisement, jerkweed."
It's a good line too.
Yeah. Now, have you ever heard the term jerkweed before?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I feel like it's just one of those random. Maybe it's because of this movie. Honestly, I mean, let's see. When this movie came out in '88, I was probably 11 when it came out, so I'm the right age to be, you know, like. That, you know, that's like what, fifth, sixth grade, middle school. Yeah, jerkweed. Yeah. But maybe it was because of this movie. I don't know. I definitely feel like that was an insult that was thrown around for sure in real life.
Yeah. Could be. So, I mean, I looked it up, and it's North America. It's American slang for an obnoxious, detestable, or stupid person, often as a contemptuous form of address, similar to jerkwad or dickweed.
Yeah, jerkwad is more to me, it was more common.
Yeah. And what it also says here is that it's what you would call a jerk instead of using an inappropriate word in front of children. Man, that jerkweed. Man, that jerkweed just cut me off.
Yeah, instead of dickweed. Right, exactly.
Exactly.
Yep.
More or less.
Yeah.
Got it. I mean, it's just it's funny that that actually John talks about that. You know, that's the way John talks. Because we hear him swearing all the time, and now you're saying jerkweed. You know. That type of thing. And you know what? You just reminded me that we forgot to talk about something yesterday when we were talking about the script. You know, we wanted to know if the quarterback, you know, the quarterback is toast is in the script, and it's not.
Oh, okay.
It was something that either Clarence Gilliard thought up at the time, or it's something that you know, they thought of on the spot to change it. Hmm. So I forgot to mention that yesterday. Sorry for anyone who was expecting it and was a little disappointed that they had to wait until today to hear it. But I'm glad that I remembered since yesterday that I didn't say that. Oops. Yeah. Sorry, guys.
Yeah. Whoops. I can't believe how unprofessional you are. Jeez.
Yeah, completely. Making people wait an extra day to find out that, that the quarterback is toast is not in the script.
Inquiring minds want to know. So, but of course. You know, it was a nice little tease. I had him come back for more, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. And then we get another shot of James. Now, you know, he finally gets to the fallen case and, he settles it down. Like it, he puts it so that it's upright and he opens it. And I mean, great editing here because they're going between James and John back and forth. You know, it goes back to John and see that John, you know, is looking down into the elevator shaft and you can see that he's holding onto the chair with the monitor and then he just pushes it off and he screams, Geronimo, motherfucker. So what do you know about the phrase Geronimo? Well, the person. The phrase.
Right. I was, yeah, you know, that's just something that it seemed like you, like skydivers would always, you know, like, either skydivers or what is it called in like paratroopers. It always just seemed like that was something. I don't know where it came from or why, but as a kid, it always seemed like if you were playing with parachutes or pretending to jump on a plane, that's something you would say. And they, in fact, even on I think it's Hot Shots Part 2 when they're all jumping out of the plane saying Geronimo, and then literally they have a native jump out and he goes me.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean that's the extent of my. Why people yell that when they jump out.
Yeah. Okay. All right. That's fair. So you are correct. It is an airborne it's a U.S. Army airborne exclamation. It's occasionally used by jumping paratroopers or more generally anyone about to jump from a great height or as a general exclamation of exhilaration. And this cry originated in the United States, but no one really knows where it came from itself. Okay. There are numerous stories as to where it came from. There are two different explanations that say that it happened in Fort Benning, Georgia, which is where the first parachute jumps started in the early 1940s. Okay, there's a paratrooper named Gerard Devlin who claims that in August 1940, he attributes it to Private Aubrey Eberhardt, who was a member of the parachute test platoon at Fort Benning. And they had only started jumping not long beforehand. And on the eve of his first jump, the platoon decided to calm their nerves by spending the day beforehand by watching a movie and then spending night at a local pub, right? The film they saw was a Western that featured the Native American Geronimo. And there's a dispute as to what movie it is. It could be the 1939 film Geronimo, which starred Andy Devine and Chief Thundercloud, who was also in The Lone Ranger, and he played Geronimo. And then on the way back to the barracks, Eberhardt, all of his friends started making fun of him that he would be too scared to remember his own name. So he said, "All right, damn it. I tell you, jokers, what I'm going to do. To prove to you that I'm not scared out of my wits, when I jump, I'm going to yell Geronimo loud as hell when I go out the door tomorrow." And he kept his promise. And apparently the cry was adopted by other members of his platoon, which you know, which you know, stuck. Now, another explanation in, I mean, you know who Richard Winters was, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. Dick Winters. Yep.
Right. From Band of Brothers. So his
Band of Brothers, yep.
His book Beyond Band of Brothers, The War Memoirs of Major Richard Winters, he gives a different explanation. He was in the 501 Parachute Infantry Regiment, also at Fort Benning. And he said there was a popular song on the radio that was called Geronimo, which everyone seemed to love. And at this point, the cry became known to the commanding officer, who insisted that they would instead jump out and cry Currie, the name of the mountain at Camp Tekoa, right? And which was their first training camp. And this is the, I mean, if anyone's seen Band of Brothers, that's in the first episode where they have to run 3 miles up, 3 miles down.
Right.
And so they say,
silver. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So they decided that they would start saying Geronimo instead of Currie because they didn't particularly like their commander. Right. And just to guard him a little bit, you know, that type of thing. And then there's a third explanation, which is the final explanation that I'll talk about it. It's that in Fort Sill, Oklahoma, which is where Geronimo was jailed as a prisoner of war and where his grave is located, there are steep cliffs that have become come to be known as Geronimo's Bluff. And people would say that Geronimo was, when he was there, he would jump off of those. And so people who wanted to be like Geronimo would go there and they would make a leap on horseback down an almost vertical cliff, a feat that the posse couldn't duplicate. Right. So the legend continued that in the middle of him jumping, he called out Geronimo. So I don't know. I because I'm a fan of Band of Brothers, I'm leaning towards the second one being my favorite of the three.
I feel like the first one's the most plausible because it's like a stupid reason why it happened, you know, and that seems like exactly what happens in the military. Like, you know, you get some sort of nickname or call sign because of a dumb reason, not because of some, you know, I don't know. I just like I could see the first one being plausible.
Yeah.
The first two actually seem the most plausible. I think the first one makes the most sense to me. Like,
yeah.
But and it could also be, like, even though it may, if it's true, it's still, the story itself could be embellished a little too.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
but it's still fun. It's still fun to think about these type of things, try and figure out where it can. I mean, again, I like the fact that apparently this is connected to Band of Brothers. You know, how did Geronimo get connected to Band of Brothers? You know, so, and at this point, the chair continues to fall and we actually get 7 seconds of the chair falling, which I find really interesting because, as I mentioned, you know, earlier, I think it was earlier today, or maybe it was yesterday. No, I think I mentioned it yesterday, the fact that when the grate fell, when he was going through the air conditioning unit, it took 7 seconds. So if my counting is correct, and I corrected, you know, it's fun that both times it's the same distance that everything is falling. You know, even if it's falling at 9.8 meters per second, you know, because we know that John is on the 32nd floor and James and Alexander are on the third floor. So there's a 29 floor discrepancy between them. And then we see a shot of James continuing to walk. And as he's walking, we see the explosion and it just like the blast consumes him. And then we get to see from the outside massive flashes all across the third floor. Now, my question about this whole thing is how did John know that he was going to be able to kill them or stop them by doing this? You know, how does he know that the guys who are shooting are right at the base of the elevator? I mean, yesterday when I was reading from the script, so it mentions the fact that, you know, he could see the top of the car. Okay, which I refrained from getting into more information about that because I want to talk about it now. So the idea, I never even thought about this before, and I thought it like hits rock bottom and then it explodes. But if that's the case, it could have taken out the whole building.
You know, I always assume it went to the bottom and exploded.
Exactly,
and
that's just, what I thought too.
It was such a big blast that it knocked them out. But also, even if I always just kind of.
But what about like Eddie and Uli who are in the lobby?
Yeah, you know what? I don't even know. I didn't even think about that. But yeah, I should have killed them too. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, again, if it hits the top of the elevator, so it explodes there, and we see throughout the course of this minute so many windows being shattered on the third floor. You know, it's as if the entire explosion just goes across the third floor. So, I mean,
it's dumb luck.
apparently.
Yeah.
Again, it's all the in the screenwriter.
Right.
You know, I mean, we see the shot from the hostage floor where like it seems as if the room is shaking a little bit and stuff like that. You know, and then we see tons of flashes and explosions from multiple locations. We see like Holly and Ellis both looking up, and we see a whole bunch of boxes that are exploding and window shattering, and we see the cops, you know, Robinson and Al, and we see them all take cover, and we see smoke coming out of the lower floor windows and stuff like that. And this whole time we see John still up there looking down the shaft to see see what's going on. And we see the fire like shoot back up and it climbs up towards him. And, you know, we can see that the axe is still in place holding the doors open. All right. And then we see a whole bunch of other like flashes that for a brief second seem to obscure John's vision through everything that's going on there. And then we see the fireball just like fly up. And at this point it hits John and he realizes what's going on, you know? And then he goes,
it's like he didn't expect it, which is weird, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
And he jumps back from the impact and is sort of thrown across the room at the same time, you know, as he's jumping and stuff like that. And at this point, we get a shot of Hans, who, you know, to quote James Bond, he looks shaken but not stirred. And at this point, we see Fritz come into the room and goes, "They're using artillery on us." And Hans just looks at him and goes, "You idiot. It's not the police. It's him." He's really getting very impatient, both with Fritz and with what John's doing.
Right.
You know, and then once again, we see a shot of the smoke outside just pouring out of these windows. You know, there's a lot of smoke. I mean, when I was watching this, I actually got flashbacks to 9/11 from seeing.
Oh, geez.
No, because you see a building where there's these billows of smoke coming out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it makes you wonder, you know, I mean, this was made 13 years before 9/11, so, you know, it wasn't based on that. But to see the way that the similarities between them is just pretty eerie to think about.
Yeah.
Yeah. So on that note.
Nice happy note.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have anything else you want to say about this minute before we get into the script discrepancies?
No. No, but I know I forget the character's name, but one of the guys is Viggo the Carpathian from Ghostbusters 2.
That's James.
Yeah. Have you gotten into just what a crazy effort that guy is in real life at all?
No, not at all. You can yeah. Go ahead.
I'll very briefly. His name is like Wilhelm von Homburg or something like that. He is I don't even want to get into it, but this dude has had horrible problems with the law, with his family, crime, and it's just he's a messed up dude. I'll just leave it at that.
His name is Willem van Homburg.
Yeah, he's
which sounds made up.
Yeah.
Oh, he actually passed away. He passed away in 2004 at the age of 63.
Yeah, he's got some serious issues, to say the least. So
I'll
leave that for.
He had.
So yeah, he's.
Well, he was a boxer. He was a wrestler and a boxer. Okay, I can understand why he would have some.
Oh yeah, dude's got demons. Let's just put it like that. You know, he played a demon. He has real life demons. Well, had real life demons. But anyways, yeah, he's. It's just funny because every time I see that character, my co-host from Marine Corps Movie Minute, we always go, it's Vigo. And so when I saw him again on this, you know, rewatch, I'm like, it's Vigo. But it's kind of hard to have fun at that when you know, like, he's such a horrible person in real life. So it's like,
oh, well,
yeah.
Anyways, yeah. I mean, IMDb doesn't go into the whole thing. It just says that he made headlines after his controversial appearance on German TV at the ZDF sports studio after the reporter made some rude, snide remarks about his boxing career and his private life. And he showed up at the at the studio. And
yeah,
there's actually a documentary, a prize-winning documentary on his life called The Boxing Prince. Wow.
Yeah, no, because he's had some he's had some real life trouble, drugs and alcohol and associations with some really bad people and some allegations about stuff he may or may not have done to his own family member. It's really bad. So,
oh wow,
the less said about it, the better.
Apparently,
but
well, his real name, you know, his real name is Norbert Group. Makes you wonder why he changed it to Wilhelm right. Von Hamburg.
Right. No kidding. So yeah,
I apologize to any Norbert groups out there who are listening to this, and I didn't mean to offend you. Just Vigo the Carpathian.
yeah, but that's all. That's really all I had for this particular minute.
So the script has a few discrepancies here. So first of all, we'll go back to the description. So it goes, the explosion like a firestorm rips across the floor, blowing out the machine gun next to James and Alexander, shattering windows, sending desks, chairs, phones, and typewriters flying. And then it goes, the police take cover behind their cars. Powell, Robinson, and Mitchell look like they've seen the face of God as the building rocks from the blast. Henry's cigarette falls from his mouth as a desk is sent hurling across the Avenue of the Stars into the trees across the street. And I don't know who Henry is. I've been reading the script and I don't recall there being someone named Henry beforehand. So I'm not really sure who Henry is referring to. They must be referring to one of the policemen that's standing there. But right. Yeah. So there's really no discrepancies here. Just I liked the descriptive nature of the whole thing. I mean, there's not much dialogue in this minute anyway. And the whole line between Fritz about the artillery only happens later on, and it's Franco who says it, not Fritz.
Huh.
So, but it's the same exact line, just a different character, who says it. All right, so every Tuesday we have a segment called Off the Beaten Track Holiday Edition, where my guest will give a story, anecdote about some sort of travel experience, event, story that has happened to him over the course of his life that's somehow related to a holiday. So what do you got for us, Brian?
I mean, it's nothing too like adventurous or funny, but just
doesn't need to be adventurous.
There's no action packed. I didn't save my family from a terrorist group in a at a Christmas party or anything like that. But
you're still just boring.
I know, right? maybe some year.
I hope not. I pray for you that you never have to worry about that.
No kidding. I appreciate that. No, just a special memory that I have at Christmas time is, each year my wife and kids and I go up to, it's like an hour away, and we go to this family farm that they do like Christmas lights and music and hay rides and they have food and you can see Santa and all that good stuff. And, I live in North Carolina, so we don't really get a lot of snow. And if we do, it shuts everything down, and it's usually in February anyways, because that's just when it seems to happen. But usually around December we go up there, and it just was like the perfect time. We got right in to see Santa. We did the, they do a little fake snow when you go through and see the lights, and they play Christmas music, and then we were like,
December in North Carolina, you have to fake the snow.
Because it's like, you have to just get by this one little like snow machine that they just put it on you for a quick.
No, minute. I'm saying that there isn't real snow in North Carolina usually. It's too hot down there.
No,
really?
I mean, it's not that we don't get it. We get snow at least once a year, but it's usually in February. It's usually a little bit here and there, or if it does snow, it shuts everything down. So, So we're, you know, they got the little fake snow, but, you know, it just was like a really good time. And we hadn't left yet. And we were like, we had supper and it was great. And then we're like, let's go out. Let's, you know, we were having such a good time. We were playing on the activities that they have there, getting like hot cocoa around the fire. And then it just started snowing. And it was like the perfect, like that kind of like just really good snow. It wasn't wet. It was coming down so much, but it was like not enough to like, oh, we have to get out of here because, you know, we have to drive an hour in this crap. It was like magical. It was like magical snow. It was like one of those, like if you were filming a Hallmark movie and it's like that would be the ending when everybody got their Christmas spirit back and we were all like having a happy time and then it starts snowing, you know, like, and then the credits would come up. And that's literally how our night ended. And it was like, it was just the best like kind of Christmas memory. You know what I mean?
Wow. That's really cool. That's very cool. All right. Thank you very much for that. Yeah. So, why don't you once again tell people where they can find Brian Lockhart on the world wide web?
Yeah, I got the Hamilton Shot by Shot podcast I do with my daughter, and that's you know, we can find us at Hamilton Shot by Shot on Instagram is a good place for us. And additionally, I'm doing a Marvel Events Timeline podcast with Travis Bowe, where we're going through Marvel, and that's at Marvel Events Pod. Also on Instagram, you can find us on Facebook and on anywhere you can find podcasts.
All right, excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. You can find me on Facebook, and you can find me on Twitter. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.